Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, where we check in with reporters around the state about the stories they've been covering. First, an F3 tornado struck the towns of Wheaton and Elk Mound in southern Chippewa County on Tuesday night, damaging dozens of homes. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He joins us from our studio there. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Rich, you went to the town of Wheaton. I saw some of your pictures of the hardest hit areas from this tornado. Give us a sense of what kind of damage was there.
It was pretty overwhelming. I mean, this is actually the second tornado that I've covered after the fact, and it reminded me a lot of what happened in 2017 to the north in Chittek. This tornado was stronger. As you mentioned, it was an EF3, and it was pretty significant destruction, especially in the town of Wheaton, where the tornado had its strongest path. The houses were just, there was one house where, by the Weather Service's account, the tornado must have landed right on top of this house. It was gone. All that was left was foundation. All you saw was debris scattered throughout farm fields, and the tornado then moved from there across the Highway 29, U.S. Highway 29, and then continued kind of northeasterly. And there was a lot of damage that wasn't in that narrow strip where this tornado was the strongest, so a lot of straight-line winds. But just, it's a really surreal experience because you're seeing just the most random objects scattered throughout. I talked with a woman who found her late father's Lionel train set scattered throughout her yard. The train engine was actually buried in the ground, and she had to dig it out. Just really strange little examples of how tremendously powerful this storm was.
And with all that property damage, was anyone hurt, or did anyone die in the course of this storm?
According to the Chippewa County Sheriff's Department, there were only two reported injuries, which is pretty amazing. Again, I bring up 2017 when the tornado went through a trailer park in Chittek, the city of Chittek, and there was one death in that and multiple injuries. I'm not sure why there weren't more. I mean, most of what was damaged was homes, and people had basements. I talked to a woman who was bringing dog food into her home, into the basement, and she started hearing loud bangs. She knew that there was this warning, so she hid under the stairs in her basement and said it was like 30 to 45 seconds of torture. It's a miracle, really, that more people weren't hurt.
And Rich, what's happening now in terms of response and cleaning up from all the damage?
Well, when I got there on Wednesday, it was probably around noon, and already there was, just as far as you could see, there was trucks and cars and heavy equipment parked up and down the roads leading up to where the worst damage was. But I'd say hundreds of people were there cutting trees. I mean, it was kind of chaotic because everyone was just in doing their thing. You know, they were clearing roads, they were pulling trees that had fallen off of houses down, and they were also picking up pieces of, you know, homes, buildings, you know, random debris. So there were so many people actually that the Chippewa County Sheriff's Department put out a request on Facebook. They said, "We have enough people, you know, it's getting congested." So the day after that, yesterday, they had another organized cleanup, and they're planning them for this weekend as well. So people are going to gather at the Wheaton Fire Hall tomorrow morning, it sounds like, and it'll be a more organized approach.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, with us to talk about damage from a tornado that hit Wheaton and Elk Mound on Tuesday. Now, Milwaukee County is ending its partnership with the nonprofit organization Southwest Key, citing its operation of an immigrant detention center on the U.S.-Mexico border. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, who is this company, Southwest Key? What has their relationship been with Milwaukee?
The relationship's actually been pretty good. Southwest Key has been a vendor of Milwaukee County for 25 years. And they right now had three contracts with the county. They've done things like day treatment for teens that have substance abuse problems. They've provided GPS monitoring programs for teens, worked with Children's Court But overall, they're a national nonprofit that does other things, including having juvenile immigration detention centers at the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's where there has been a problem.
Right. What are we hearing from the county now as new contract proposals are coming up?
So the county says that they've been thinking about this for about a year, and they just are so morally opposed to what's been going on with immigration and, you know, on the federal level, that they are not going to renew the contracts when they are up at the end of the year.
And that says kind of there's been a national protest movement in some ways against companies that make money from anything related to the border situation. Is that the argument from the county here in effect?
It is. So these county contracts are worth $2.5 million, and the county has said that, you know, they need to kind of act with their wallet, and they're going to just be ending this. They also looked into their other contracts to see if there were any issues, and at this point they say no. Now, on Southwest Key's part, they've said that they've had these contracts along the border since 1997, and that they really don't make the decisions about these types of what goes on at the border. So they're just kind of the middleman here.
So what happens with the programs that Southwest Key has been operating in Milwaukee County and the people who work on those programs?
Well, there's about 40 people that are working, and Milwaukee County says that they are going to work hard to try to put these employees in other positions throughout the county, maybe try to get them jobs with other contractors.
All right, Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Corinne Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked with us about Milwaukee County ending its relationship with the nonprofit Southwest Key due to its operation of an immigrant detention center on the southern U.S. border. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our weekly state news roundup by heading to northern Wisconsin. This Wednesday at Northland College in Ashland, more than 200 people came to a meeting on Great Lakes water quality held by the International Joint Commission. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for being here again.
Hey, Rob. Happy Friday.
Well, tell us about this International Joint Commission and why they're having this meeting here in Wisconsin.
They're having the meeting really across the Great Lakes, and so this is kind of their final stop as they've been doing a tour. They have one in Duluth this week and one in Ashland, and they've been getting public input from people about their concerns affecting water quality of the Great Lakes. And, you know, in Ashland, it was kind of far-ranging. I mean, it spanned from climate change to algal blooms to pollution from a variety of sources as some of the chief concerns that people had.
And who is this International Joint Commission, and what is their responsibility for the Great Lakes?
Yeah, the International Joint Commission really cooperates to manage the waters of the Great Lakes and protect them. And they have kind of two main responsibilities. They approve projects that affect water levels and flows across the lakes. And then they also make recommendations on, you know, issues like water usage, whether that affects drinking water or commercial shipping or ecosystem health.
One issue you've talked about with us, Danny, on the show before is the impact of what seemed to be heavier and more frequent rainfall in northern Wisconsin on the shores of Lake Superior. Is that something people talked about at this meeting?
Yeah, definitely. People wanted to see more resiliency built into infrastructure and planning for these types of storm events in the future because, you know, we've seen millions of dollars in damage here in northern Wisconsin. You know, just with the 2016 storm that was here spanning several counties across northern Wisconsin, they saw more than $38 million of damage. That's one single storm event. And then it's been repeated through several storms that have been either 100 to 1,000 year storms that this region has seen. And so that those costs add up over time, not just in terms of dollar amounts, but also the human costs and the toll it takes on the community.
You mentioned the algal blooms. Is this something that seems to be becoming more common in Lake Superior?
Well, they've definitely seen them coming up in recent years. I think the first year that they saw this on Lake Superior was in 2012, and then they saw it again in 2016 and 2017 and 2018. And they definitely believe researchers that have been working on this, like an aquatic ecologist with the National Park Service, Brenda LaFrancois, they're making this correlation between these storm events and the appearance of these blooms, because the thought is, you know, when this rain falls down, it's causing higher flows and rushing water into the lake, and that's bringing nutrients with it and creating more of an ideal condition for these blooms to form.
Is the International Joint Commission still taking comments from people even if they couldn't make it to this series of meetings?
They absolutely are, Rob. They're taking comments until October 31st.
And in other Great Lakes news, Danny, you were at a celebration last week for a restoration project on the shoreline of Wisconsin Point. Tell us about that spot, first of all.
Yeah, well, Wisconsin Point and Minnesota Point in nearby Duluth make up really one of the largest freshwater sandbars in the world. Wisconsin Point, I think, is about 229 acres, and it really spans around 3 miles across the shoreline of Lake Superior. And this project focused on restoration of 150 acres of sensitive coastal habitat along the lake.
And you write that this is a special place for a lot of people and a sacred place for some residents of the area. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin Point holds special significance to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. It's part of the tribe's migration story, and it's the site where many of their ancestors were buried.
And what actually happened then in this restoration project?
So this restoration project restored sensitive dune habitat. About 85,000 square feet of shoreline was restored, along with 85 acres of forest. They put in ADA accessible boardwalks so that more people could access the area. And they also consolidated parking lots while making them bigger so that people would have more space and more access, but also while cutting down on that foot traffic that could really damage that dune habitat.
Danny, thanks for bringing us up to date on both of those stories.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about a public meeting in Ashland on Great Lakes water quality and the restoration of a coastal habitat in Superior. She closed out our state news roundup. If you're a parent or you spend a lot of time around kids, you might have had a lot of questions about everything, from why the sky is blue to why apples taste like apples. Sometimes they might ask about things that many adults want to talk or think about, including maybe questions about death. A lot of grown-ups may not have the answers. It's a good chance our next guest does. Caitlin Doty is a mortician and an author. Her latest book is called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you get a lot of questions about death, and you really put yourself out there, but you say some of the best questions come from kids. Why is that?
I think because kids have not yet been beaten down by our culture and by our ideas and our morals around death and how you should or shouldn't talk about it. The title of the book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs, was actually a young boy in Australia who raised his hand and asked that question. And I just laughed. The whole crowd laughed. And it was this expression of, wow, what a fascinating way to ask that. What a spot on. It gets into all of our existential anxieties as adults, but yet is done in such a charming, direct way that truly only children can do.
And now you're not tackling the metaphysical questions like what, you know, is there consciousness after death? Is there an afterlife or something like that? You get into like really nuts and bolts stuff about what our bodies do after we're not in them anymore.
Exactly. This is dead body stuff, because that's a little above my pay grade. I'm not a child psychiatrist. I'm more a weird aunt that happens to know a whole lot about the science and facts about what happens to a dead body. And children, yes, they ask about where someone goes after they die, but they also want to know, is grandma sleeping down there in the casket? What's happening in the casket? What's happening to that bird that's decomposing on the street? What does this mean? And that's where I think that anxieties can really be lifted by not making it such a taboo big deal to have questions about what is essentially science and the reality of death.
Yeah, do we lose something as grown-ups when we're too, I don't know, squeamish, or we find it too unpleasant to want to think about this stuff?
It is, and honestly, this book is for children, but it's also equally for adults, because many adults never learn these things, never had these conversations, don't have a high death literacy, which means that when your own mother dies, you're sending her off to a funeral home to maybe be embalmed, maybe be cremated, maybe be buried, and you don't actually know what happens during those procedures, and you don't really know what those mean. So you're sending someone behind the scenes to be prepared by a funeral director, but there's so much anxiety that comes with simply not knowing the facts. And if we can learn them when we're young and they're just part of our viewpoint, as they do in many other cultures around the world, then we don't have to grow up fearing death so much.
You tackle a lot of questions in this book. I don't want to spoil them all, but if it's okay, I'd like to get into a couple few of them.
Oh, yeah.
While
yeah,
we've got
absolutely.
You here. Okay, so I think a lot of us have probably seen one of those authentic depictions of a Viking funerals where you're out on the boat and they shoot the flaming arrow on you and you're incinerated on the boat. You write there's about two things wrong with that picture that will make it really hard for us to do it ourselves.
This makes me feel bad, this one, because I want to support everyone's biggest death dream, and that may be a flaming boat for you. Unfortunately, first of all, not actually what the Vikings did. Second of all, what happens is the body, the human body, will take much longer to cremate than it will to burn the wood in the boat. And a real open-air pyre cremation takes a large amount of wood over several hours to complete. So once that boat burns up, all you have is a half-charred body bobbing around in whatever municipal waterway you've done this epic Viking cremation. So maybe it might be better to do the cremation first and then put the ashes in a tiny boat and set it on fire. I'm not suggesting you should set things on fire in your local waterway, but just if, you know, wink, wink, off you go.
And the whole Viking boat burial thing, they did, you write, sometimes, you know, if you're a really important Viking dude, you might get the burning boat funeral, but it was on dry land.
Exactly. Or, even more interesting, they would haul your whole big boat longship up onto land and bury you with the boat.
With the whole boat.
Exactly, with the whole boat, which is also really cool, but neither of those was sending the boat out and doing the cremation on the water, because as we know, nothing ruins a cremation faster than water.
Talking to Caitlin Doty, mortician. Her new book is Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Okay, Caitlin, some of the questions in the book, I read them and I think, okay, yeah, I've thought about that before. This one I did not. This is a thing people think about. Before I die, people say I'm going to just swallow a whole bunch of popcorn, unpop popcorn, and just freak people out when I get cremated. What?
This comes
people
from
have told
a
you
meme.
This. Okay.
Yeah, well, it comes from a meme. It was all over Facebook that says, right before I die, I'm going to swallow all this popcorn and then my cremation's going to be epic. Which is a funny thought, the idea of, I'm imagining they think it's going to overflow from the stomach or out of the machine like a fountain that a prankster puts in and it overflows the school hallways. I'm not exactly sure. But the problem is that, first of all, you would have to swallow so much popcorn to have it have any effect. You're not going to be sitting there on your deathbed holding your wife's hand
popcorn.
And swallowing, you know, massive, like gallons of Pop Secret. Second of all, we know that popcorn has to be exactly the right temperature, exactly the right everything to pop nicely. There have been thermodynamic engineers that have studied the exact precise pop point of popcorn. Not going to be in your stomach compacted in there. And third, the temperature in a cremation machine is 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. It's essentially a blast furnace coming down on your stomach. That's going to blast right through any popcorn, any tissue, anything inside of you. There's no situation where the popcorn will overfloweth out of the machine.
Wow. Okay, so I will not. I mean, honestly, I wasn't planning on trying this one.
I feel like I'm just killing dreams here, left and right.
But it wasn't my. That one was not my dream.
I'm the mean mortician.
All right, there's a lot in here, Caitlin. What's one you want to talk about that you love to tell people that maybe surprises people?
I think that most people they don't really, when somebody actually comes into my funeral home, let's say, they're not asking these big questions like, can I keep my dad's skull? Can I do, they're mostly in the, you know, let's have a cremation, let's have a natural burial, let's do this instead. But the skull one, people are fascinated by. They cannot understand why they are not allowed to just keep dad's skull as a Thanksgiving centerpiece or on the bookshelf. And it's all about something called abuse of corpse laws, which essentially are in each state and say that you have to have a dignified way that does not outrage ordinary family sensibilities, which who knows what that means, but you can't have anything that goes against the basic idea of cremation, burial, or donation to science. So if you brought your dad into my funeral home and said, how do we get his skull off and defleshed and back to me, I wouldn't even know how to help you. Talk about above my pay grade. That's really above my pay grade.
Of all the details in the book, one that really stood out to me when you were talking about the can I keep somebody's skull, you consulted with one of your good friends who is a lawyer who is an expert in treatment of remains. You've got what sounds like a really interesting circle of friends.
Oh, they're the best. Yeah. There was Tanya Marsh, who is the lawyer at Wake Forest University, who is an incredible resource because she knows more about the laws surrounding dead bodies than anyone else in the country and possibly the world. And to have her on your team is great. There's also an entomologist named Peter Coffey who broke open for me the idea that, okay, bugs don't usually eat the bones, but if the bones are soft enough, like those of a fetal lamb, they'll not only eat the flesh, they'll also chew through the bones as well, which I had no idea. So I learned things writing this book too.
The Ideas Network is your source for great dinner time conversation. No, maybe not on that one. Caitlin, your title is a tease here. What are our pets, our four-legged friends, going to do if we die and we're not feeding them anymore?
Well, good news and bad news. Good news is that you have a while. If nobody finds you for several days, they're not getting any food, that's when the eating might start, especially with cats. Cats have a compact with you that says you're supposed to feed them. If you don't, they will very well go for your lips or your eyeballs, maybe even your tongue, soft parts, exposed parts on your face. Dogs, on the other hand, what they found is that the impulse is much more connected to their anxiety. So dogs have a connection with their humans. And when you're not waking up, when they can't get you to move, when they can't get you to feed them, they start nipping and tugging at you to wake you up. And that can cause the same effect as what a cat is doing, but cats may have more selfish reasons, which frankly,
sounds about right.
I get it. Yeah, people are like, oh, that means dogs are better. No, I appreciate what the cat's doing. The cat is saying, listen, I have to survive here. I'm going to do what I need to do. So I relate to that.
As we wrap up, Caitlin, again, your questions here came from kids. The kids populated this book with questions for you. For grownups who aren't morticians, who get questions like this about the physical realities of what happens to our bodies after we die, how could the parents out there tackle that?
Be honest. Treat your child like a little adult. I don't mean that you have to give super, super intense details on every one of these answers. Of course, you don't have to do that. But if your child is 7, 8, 9, they're at an age where they can understand these things, tell them the science behind it. Tell them the facts behind it. Don't, skirt around it, because they're going to know that you're hiding something from them. Here's the thing. If I tell you, don't think about a purple cow, whatever you do, don't think about a purple cow, what are you going to think about? A purple cow. That's what's in your head now. So if we tell them that about death, just don't think about it. It's bad. It's morbid. That's all they're going to think about it. Just let them be interested, be curious, and I promise it won't ruin them.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Give to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks. That's Caitlin Doty, mortician and author. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. She joins us to talk about death and the questions kids have about the end of life and some of the science of what happens to us, to our bodies after we die.